If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
Some of you may know that I grew up in a family business run by my dad, a grocery store, but it had a butcher shop. It was known far and wide on the Southwest side, and I know that quality means something, and that's why we drive 2 hours from Northwest Indiana all the way to the Northwest side of the city of Chicago to Joseph's Finest Meats at 7101 West Addison Street. Before you go there, you got to be prepared, so I've got a list for you. Do you have a pen? Italian sausage, hot. Italian sausage, mild. Get pork chops, but order them thick. And of course, get some beef too, like bone-in ribeye steaks. Nothing like it. And if you don't know exactly what to get or how to cook it, ask Ben or Sal and tell them John Cass sang. And I'd like to tip my hat to Joseph, the patriarch, the owner, the founder who built this store for his family with his two sons, Ben and Sal. In his mid-90s, he had serious heart surgery and he made a triumphant return. He loves his place, and I do too. And so does anyone who shops there. It's like family. They care about the details. They care about you. Joseph's Finest Meats, 7101 West Addison Street, Chicago. A family tradition since 1977, and a proud sponsor of John Cass News and the Chicago Wave Podcast.
Hello, Chicago Wave fans. Jeff Carlin here, your friendly co-host and executive producer at WGN Radio. John Cass is a little under the weather this weekend, so it'll be Charles Lipson and myself breaking down what is happening in Iran. Maybe not nuts and bolts on the ground, but kind of big picture. Charles Lipson, our friend, Professor Emeritus from University of Chicago, he had a great piece out in the beginning of March that kind of set the table for what to expect or what the implications of a war in Iran would be. And he has actually, since he wrote that, moved to Austin. So I want to get a look in and see what's going on with Charles and get his take on what's happening in Iran from his new abode in Austin. Here is Charles Lipson on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago Way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
The Chicago Way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
So, as promised, friend of the show, Charles Lipson, the Peter B. Ritzma Professor Emeritus at the University of Chicago, our friend, fantastic author of many articles that have grown my perspective and worldview and helped me have a bigger brain, I'd like to think. Charles, how are you today?
I'm doing just fine. My brain is shrinking as yours is getting bigger.
Well, it's my benefit, I guess, and my future students, I'd like to think. But Charles, big news in your life. I've heard you told us, rather, that you have moved to Austin. You fled Illinois?
Yes, I'm one of the many exiles. But I was drawn here because both of my adult children live in the Austin area with their wives, and it's wonderful to be near them. Mm. We loved Chicago. There were all the normal things that caused people to move out. As they say about Chicago, come for the culture, stay because you've been shot. we're happy here. And I must say, I went to a minor league game with friends and family last night in the area, and sat where you could, where our hands were on the visitor's box. You know, in other words, we were right on the first baseline. But it was just wonderful. I like minor league ball, which is why I guess I've always liked the White Sox. I asked the world to not put out much news while I was doing this move, but once again, the world failed to listen to me.
I know when you were discussing your preparations for the move, and you were going to take, probably take some time off to from writing and doing things to, get it across the country. And your last column was, what does Iran mean to the world? And flash forward a month later, and what does the Iran mean to the world? I mean, it seems like people are starting to carve out their own little line in the sand about what Iran really means to them, or how far they're going to go for whatever's happening in Iran.
Exactly. Let's step back and take some big picture stuff.
Yeah.
I'd say that the first thing is that the media mainstream and more conservative media both are correct in saying that a lot really hinges on reopening the Straits of Hormuz because a substantial portion of the world's energy supply moves through there, and more than just the energy supply, fertilizer and a lot of other things. So temporary closure is one thing. If there's a long-term closure, it's another. And the closure is simply because the Iranians can threaten, credibly threaten, one or two ships with being damaged, and that changes the insurance posture, and it changes the posture of a captain and crew who want to just take a civilian vessel through. The other thing I would say is that we still don't know where all the enriched uranium is. We know that Iran did not need that uranium to be enriched at the very high levels it was for anything other than a nuclear weapon. And I think what's been missing, besides the fact that I think President Trump, I've supported the war, but I think that President Trump made a mistake in not sitting down with the American people and giving a clear talk at the very outset about why Iran was a danger. And let me just say, I think that in the torrent of words that have been spilled about the war, I think what's been missing is the political courage that Donald Trump had. And let me say why I think it's courage. I think he could have kicked the can down the road as every other president did and let the problem really settle on his successors in 3 years, 4 years. He didn't do that. And I think he didn't do it knowing that even if it were successful, it would not be very helpful to him or his party. We know that from history that so I think it took a lot of courage. Now, if it doesn't work out well, people will say it took a lot of stupidity. I think
Well,
it
right, there's the rub, right? I mean,
there's
in
the rub.
hindsight, one man's stupidity is another man's brilliance. Do you
You
think
must hear that a lot, Jeff. You know,
it,
I know.
I think it a lot.
Every JotCast news column starts with an idea that is watered by a good cup of coffee. That search for the perfect cup is where my love of coffee and writing began. And that perfect cup comes from Kribi Coffee, K-R-I-B-I Coffee, roasted locally in Chicago. Kribi's latest offering is Big Bloom, with sweet floral brightness and berry notes. This Ethiopian blend is the perfect spring cup of coffee. And because it's air roasted, it's never bitter, you can enjoy that moment savoring the backyard, your garden, or your kitchen window. Bloom in a 12-ounce bag. Or try the Kribi Tasting Trio, featuring Mount Oku Light Roast, Hyper Slap Dark Roast, and Big Bloom. As always, Cribby Coffee offers roast level and grind that are fully customizable for all coffees online or in the cafe. Cribby also gives back by supporting African coffee farmers and creating jobs in Chicago's North Lawndale neighborhood through their new roastery. You can order at cribbycoffee.com. It's perfect for Easter, Mother's Day, or a thoughtful just because, or any coffee lover. You stop by in a beautiful April morning or May morning, you might want to bring a coffee cake, and you got the Cribby Coffee. That's the way to slow down the mind and be ready to meet the day. Carpe diem with Cribby Coffee, a proud sponsor of John Cass News and the Chicago Way Podcast. Cribby Coffee, K-R-I-B-I-Coffee.com. Cheers.
Do you think that the Iran situation, he like you said, he could have kicked the can down the road. He did take some action. I mean, those bomb strikes were, they were PR perfection, right? They were quick. They happened. They were seemed successful. And it was what you expected someone to do. And I think, like you said, if he had come out ahead of this and then maybe said, you know, this is happening right now, it's imminent, we can't wait any longer, he might have been able, it might have been easier to swallow for some people. But Charles, I see this, and this is because it could go so sideways, and it already hasn't, you know, really moved as quickly as I think Trump wanted.
Right.
He has a real strong legacy, and you know, I make these comments to a lot of my liberal friends, very liberal friends, and you know, they turn their heads sideways and say, I'm not saying Trump is good or bad in any sort. I'm just saying, if you look at the sheer volume of things he's done in his two terms,
right,
it's incredible. I mean, it's just a workload that no other president has matched.
And he did it while
right,
they were trying to impeach him. And I think we're going to see a kind of massive conspiracy case coming out of Florida, but we can talk about that later.
Yeah. Yeah. That might be a future distraction. There you go. A future story for us. But on this, why do you think he's taken the risk, has, you know, been brave, as you said, on Iran? Because if this goes sideways, I mean, it could really crater his whole legacy.
Right.
You know, it's not the first thing you do, it's the last thing you do. And he's a lame duck president in a sense, and really, and after the midterms especially. Why would he do this? Unless it was extremely imminent that the world was going to face some sort of absolute horror at the hands of Iran. And if that was the case, why didn't he come out ahead of time? Because it just reeks of all the other wars every president in my lifetime has gotten us into.
Right. And for those of us who are older, it reeks of Lyndon Johnson in the Vietnam War, where he had this huge domestic agenda, mm-hmm. A domestic agenda that I think is not proven on the ground nearly as successful as he wanted, and launched the big government that we now see today. Mm-hmm. But Lyndon Johnson's presidency was destroyed by the Vietnam War and the failure there. But why did Trump do it? And this is, I think, what he should have leveled with the American people about. It was not because he was pulled in by Israel, which is what Tucker Carlson and the kind of anti-Jewish right are trying to say. Israel did play an important role in why the war may have been launched exactly when it was, but he had already moved massive amounts of U.S. troops and equipment into the area. It was launched exactly when it was because Israeli intelligence found out, and American intelligence confirmed, that essentially all of Iran's leadership was meeting in one place at one time and could be taken out, and was taken out in a swift blow. But here was the bigger problem. Iran, after the 12-day war that you referenced earlier, after its nuclear facilities were severely damaged. They were not obliterated, all of them, in the way that Trump said, but they were severely damaged. We learned something very important. which was that Iran immediately started rebuilding them. That is, it learned nothing. And it was going to maintain that challenge. And if you didn't want to keep bombing them every 6 months, you had to deal with that. And then the second thing we learned, besides the fact that they were absolutely intent on delivering, building a deliverable nuclear weapon, was that they were building huge numbers of medium-range missiles and cruise missiles that could overwhelm every potential opponent in the Middle East, not just Israel, but all the Gulf Arab states and so forth. And when you overwhelm them, that is, it's not possible to knock them all down with interceptor rockets. And the interceptor rockets themselves cost several million dollars each. So, what they were going to do, and then the final point about that is that you could say, well, North Korea has nuclear weapons and has the ability to deliver them. But North Korea, crazy as it is, has so far proved to be a kind of, in a sense, ordinary evil regime. Whereas I think the problem with Iran was that they had a kind of millenarian instinct where you just couldn't be sure that if they were in real trouble, they wouldn't just launch a nuclear attack that would devastate the world. It really did form a threat. And that, I think, was what Trump was addressing. I don't think that, I think the Israelis fully understood that. And I think from the Israeli point of view, they really have to get rid of the regime. But I don't think that Trump, he has certainly not stated that clearly. He sometimes says it, sometimes doesn't. But that's the nature of the threat he was trying to address. What do you think about that threat, Jeff?
Well, it's my father was a history teacher, so growing up, I always peppered him with everything I could about history because I was that's what I love to read. I read the encyclopedia because we get free a
Good
lot of
for
free time
you.
as a kid. Yeah, it was
Good
always
for
fun,
you.
and so I would always have lots of questions about history stuff. And one of the things my dad has always talked about is his concern, his whole life, the idea that there are bad regimes out there getting weapons like nuclear weapons and, someone just doing something awful. And he's always talked about that. And he's always talked about the idea that Iran, especially post, 1970s, America was he's like that. They're the biggest threat. The Russians we weren't worried about because unless it was a branch off government, some breakaway piece. He's like, that's what's going to happen. And that could happen in any country where they're not stable. And so obviously that, in my lifetime, it's always been a concern. Iraq, Iran, all of that.
You know, there's a story. I can't remember. You may know. Is it a Mark Twain story about the cat that won't sit on it's burned, so it won't sit on a hot stove, and then the problem is it won't sit on a cold stove either. And the U.S. problem in the Middle East is that we've been burned so often that it's always hard to know if we're getting into the same problem again or if it's a different problem.
And it's all the same words. Trust us, this is this. I just don't, and again, you said if he had come out and said, this is, we've got weapons of mass destruction are eminently, I hate to say it, but that's where we were when I was a kid, when I was a little kid. And
Exactly.
that's where we were when I was in high school. And that's what I mean.
Don't make me feel this old man.
Anyway,
Really.
so move away from that. I was amazed that he has made such a flag planted in the Middle East that Trump is going to completely, restructure the Middle East, and that's his hope, but starting with Iran.
You said something that I really want to underscore that's so important. The amount of trust that Americans have in the government is so low now. If you go back to the late 1950s, 70% of the public in public opinion polling said that they basically trusted the government. Now those numbers are lower than a used car salesman. And they have been compounded now by the fact that if Trump says something, if Trump could say that the sun rises in the east,
Sure.
and if you identify as a Democrat, you're going to say, not just verify it, but I don't believe that. And if Obama or Pelosi or Hakeem Jeffries or Chuck Schumer says the sun rises in the east, you've got every true blue Republican, true red Republican, would say, I don't believe it. They're just saying it because the teachers union wants them to say it. So there's just this massive lack of trust, and it's in general, and it's been compounded by this very deep partisan divide. We used to have one final point. We used to have a situation where if you and I disagreed about issue A, we might agree about issue B and disagree about issue C and agree about issue D. That's just no longer true. If we disagree about A, we probably disagree about B, C, D, all the way to Z. Don't you think?
I mean, politics, yeah, there's no doubt. And whether it's you actually, are supporting your own self-interest or just the cause, whatever that cause may be, in light of or even in the face of your own self-interests, I think we are at that point for sure. I think there are more people now ever who are actively working against themselves and just have been convinced otherwise. And that goes on both ways. I mean, totally goes both ways.
And I think that people believe increasingly that people who disagree with them don't just have a different view, they're sort of bad people.
Oh, sure. And Charles, my education involves radio and marketing, and I now physics and education. I think it's interesting. We come down on a view on something, whatever, and we can't have a conversation about it. But I think that the biggest kind of change in where we are now versus where we were 100 years ago or 150 years ago, whatever, is marketing. And marketing wasn't a thing. It was a thing. It always has been a thing. People, advertise, but advertising is only a very slim piece of marketing. Communications and how we everything we see, from the colors to the shapes to the textures, everything in our lives, is marketing, one way or another. And in marketing, really is just a transfer of information. And in this modern era, marketing has become so weaponized and powerful, down to the core of our being and how our brains function. Every media company has psychologists, especially your Metas and your Apples. They work on psychologists to hook people into their products and keep them there. And we're in that world where that weaponization is in everything. And this is, we're in a country where where doctors are convincing people in the 50s to smoke cigarettes, for God's sakes. That's where we started. Imagine if you think about it, it could only go up from there as far as the power of making people do something that's against their own best interest. And I don't think people take the time to realize that there's a difference between facts and information and information communication that comes from you from marketing.
So true.
And in that realm, it leaves the devil's playground wide open for people to mess with all sorts of things.
Let me make two observations about what you said. The first, you're mentioning doctors. I've seen those old commercials. They're print commercials, so you can still pull them up. 8 out of 10 doctors recommend, or smoke Camel cigarettes
Right.
or something like
Parliament's
that.
for that cough. You'll thank us later, you know.
Yeah, really, you'll be seeing us quite a lot.
Yeah.
But one reason that worked in the 50s was that people trusted they trusted doctors. They trusted people in authoritative positions. You know more than I do because you're a physicist or you're a doctor or you're a politician or whatever. You've seen data that I haven't seen. You know how to process it, and I can take your word for it. We just don't believe that anymore. There's a mistrust.
Yeah.
But the other thing I would say is that the fragmentation of media is just striking, and that's partly a function of technology. So, as late as the 70s, even the 80s, there were three major networks. Certainly
Right.
in the 60s, you listened to Walter Cronkite or you listened to Huntley Brinkley,
Right.
and people trusted them. When Walter Cronkite ended his newscast by saying, "And that's the way it is," people would laugh at that today. But the important point is, there aren't Walter Cronkites today. People who listen to Tucker Carlson already agree with that kind of a point of view, or people who listen to MS Now already agree with that point of view. So, but even if and if the broadcaster who was on those stations begin to say things that they disagree with, they'll just tune out that channel and tune in a different one. So there's no doctors from the 1950s who are saying smoke these cigarettes, and everybody's listening to them.
Right. No, I mean that's and it's in a way it's the marketing of education. We have people, you know, my whole lifetime is get a 4-year degree and you'll be all right and you'll go to college. And I think the value of a college degree has certainly gone down in my lifetime. And I think that was kind of the panacea that people are like, well, if I've got a degree, then I know as much as any of these experts and I can, you know, make my own decisions for myself. Or so, and I think as we became more educated, we realized that that wasn't, you know, that we don't need these experts. They're not experts, or there are other experts, or, you know, whatever reasoning.
Well, a couple of big things are changing besides the cost of a college degree and whether that's working. We're really in the midst of a tectonic change in how our economy operates. The only thing that's like it, two historical moments. One was in the 1820s when you had the first wave of industrialization. And the second was in the 1890s to 1910s when you had the big industries that came in and made Chicago, made Gary, Indiana, and so forth. So we're in a moment where AI, combined with pervasive communications, is really changing everything. And as a result, you have people are just uncertain about whether a college degree means anything. And the other thing is that a college degree at one point used to certify one thing coming in and one thing going out. What it certified coming in was that you were qualified enough to be a student, to be enrolled as a student at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And the other is that when you graduated, you had a certain level of capability, or you could not have made it through your 4 years and graduated. And I think people no longer believe either of those things is true.
Oh, it's certainly not true. I mean, I can't tell you how many young people who don't have, who are, you know, fresh out of college. I got my, you know, I got my marketing degree, or I got my quote business degree, or whatever. And they have no organizational skills. They can't manage time. You try to set them on a, you know, here are the things I need you to do. Oh, I ran out of time, and you know, I didn't get them done. And yeah, I didn't tell anybody. Well, why didn't you tell anybody?
Well, I would say, and this is a concrete piece of advice, there are some degrees that you just couldn't get unless you were
Oh,
capable
surely.
intellectually and studied hard. And there are
Surely.
other degrees that essentially are, it's not, the degree itself doesn't certify that you had much capability.
Right.
You might have a lot, but if you majored in physics, it doesn't matter what university you graduated from, you're a capable
Right.
at a whole variety of complex cognitive tasks. You just can't say that of every major.
No.
So that's important.
Yeah, and it's I feel like we get to the point where we say we don't trust these things, and now we're seeing that. Do we trust what's going on in the world across the world? And I don't know, one, if we ever get back to a place where we trust enough, or there's enough trust in our fellow people.
Well, I think that one of the things that we need to get back to is a sense that the basic foundations of our civilization are good, which is not to say that there aren't a lot of problems. But just take slavery as an example. Slavery obviously is an awful thing, and when it's race-based, that adds even more to it, to how pernicious it was. But it is also true, and this is in no excuse, but it is also true that slavery has existed throughout history. What is unique about Anglo-American civilization in particular is that we abolished it. The British abolished it in the 1830s, and the Americans had a great civil war, of whom the greatest figures are two people from Illinois, Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant, who, hundreds of thousands of ordinary soldiers who risked their lives to end it. And so we need to, as we approach the 250th anniversary of our country's birth, we need to recognize that we want to paint a true picture, warts and all, but the warts aren't all the face. The face includes some warts, but warts aren't the face.
No, it's true, and I think that's lost on a lot of people. That we have imperfect union.
Yes, yes, yes.
That's the title of this experiment in my mind. And I think we, I do say, I will say, in not necessarily the demographic of people who are 20 to 40 at the moment, but the younger, the kids who are teenagers and younger now, I think they have seen the best in some of us and the worst in some of us through COVID and through all sort and through just life in general right now. And I think it has made them more cohesive in their it, to compared to the rest of us. I think they see all the rest of us who've come before them as a lot more us versus them. And they're more like we got to get together, because you're seeing a growth in teenagers getting away from smartphones, doing dumb phone kind of technology, getting together and doing things. I've got a 17-year-old, 18-year-old niece, and she goes and meets her friend, one of her friends that she doesn't have any classes with right now, but she had classes with, a couple years ago in high school. And they have a they once a month they get together at a coffee shop and they play Scrabble. And my niece is terrible at Scrabble. But yeah, but they seek that out, and you're seeing it online. You're seeing a lot more young people asking, where do I go to meet people? Like I want to be in the same room now. I'm tired of this. And I think there's hope there. And I think the sheer uncertainty of technology and what they've seen technology be able to do in its in glory and the scariness of it in AI, I think it has put them at a pause on the world that was before them. And I am very hopeful that that generation that's coming up right now that are, in their teens are going to be the greatest generation this country's ever seen, because they've seen so many sides of the coin and seen, in my mind, in my view, as a citizen and Denzian, and I think we're at one of the lowest points in the strength of our democracy and the efficacy of our democracy. But the beauty of it, and why I think it is an incredible feat, is that we've written into it the ability to fix it, to change it, to take ownership of it on a personal level across the country. And I think at that time is coming.
That's one of the
Nice.
most hopeful statements I've heard recently, Jeff. And I know you are working with a lot of high school age kids, and you will be a teacher of many, many more. So I hope that your experience over time bears out your optimism, because that would be a wonderful thing. My concern right now is actually that the kind of it's a very strange moment. We have 4.3% official unemployment. That's a historic low.
What?
Historic low. That kind of number means essentially everybody's employed.
Right.
And yet you hear a lot of pessimism about the future. I think part of that is related to the fact that people have taken on a lot of debt. We don't have, people are unsure about the social safety net and so forth. I think part of it is because, as we said earlier, we're in the midst of a tremendous economic transformation. So if you are training to be an electrician or a truck driver or a computer coder or whatever you're training to do, you can't really be sure that that particular job will be here even 10 years from now. If you're expecting to drive a truck, will you be replaced by AI truck driving? So I mean, it's a really interesting
Right.
and dynamic time, and that Chinese phrase, "May you live in interesting times," is not a happy phrase, and we do live in interesting times, Jeff.
Yeah, we do. I pack a lot into it every minute of every day, it seems like. Well, Charles, I know you're still settling in Austin, but you're working on anything that we can keep our eyes out for?
Well, I'm trying to make sure that our government doesn't tumble out of control. Right now, the main thing I'm trying to do is get out of all the boxes that surround me in my house. But
Sure.
I have a couple of major projects that I'm working on, and as you know, I write op-eds regularly. I haven't for the last couple of weeks, but I'll get back to it. And anybody who's interested can go to Charles Lipson, Lipson, CharlesLipson.com, and sign up. They're free, and I'm happy to have the listeners of John Cass and Jeff Carlin's podcast join me and comment on my articles and tell me where I'm right and tell me where I'm wrong.
Absolutely. And measure your brain first, because once you get into them, that's where it's going to grow. Charles, it's always good to talk to you. Thanks for stepping in. I know John's a little under the weather today, but he'll hopefully be up in the saddle again soon. But yeah, Charles, always good. I don't like you being so far away now, but that's okay. Hyde Park isn't the same without you.
Well, I appreciate your saying that, and it's a pleasure to chat with you, Jeff. John, get well soon.
Absolutely. Well, for Charles Lipson, our friend and our big thinker here on the Chicago Way, and of course myself, Jeff Carlin, executive producer at WGN Radio, friend of Cats, baker of pies, and John Cass, editor-in-chief of John Cass News, where you always get a good cup of Midwestern common sense. Please like, subscribe, tell your friends, check out charleslipson.com. You will not be disappointed. And we'll see you next time on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.